This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 30th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as support for military action in Syria narrows among Western powers, human rights groups call for more thorough investigations into last week's attacks near Damascus and a referral to international courts. Transparency advocates urge more public debate after leaked government documents show a massive federal budget for surveillance. And we'll go to Seattle, Washington, where the nation's largest food forest is feeding the community and creating a sustainable ecosystem. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. As the United States and France move towards military action in Syria, Syrian Americans are voicing concern for the safety of their families back in the Middle East. FSRN's Teresa Campagna reports from Chicago.
Anti-war protesters in several cities worldwide will march Saturday, saying a Western intervention in Syria will only intensify the war already happening on the ground. This morning, both President Obama and President Hollande of France told the press they want military intervention, despite their allies' vote against it in the UK.
My cousin was on his way to his senior exam, for his high school, his college exam, and it was the same day that the university was bombed.
That's Basil Al-Madani, a Syrian American in Chicago, who has been sending money to family in Syria since February. He says most Syrians are getting by, despite the war. But like many Syrian Americans, Al-Madani wants it to end so his family can move on. Teresa Campagna, FSRN, Chicago.
Thousands of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood came out in large numbers today in several Egyptian cities. Protesters like engineer Mustafa Hadi filled the streets in Nasser City, calling for a return to democratic rule after the takeover by General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
When el-Sisi and his supporters speak of people, they only mean their supporters, okay? We cannot know where is the majority and what is the majority choice unless we have elections. And they decided to kill us if we say no.
FSRN's Sean David Hobbs was in Nasser City. He witnessed the crowd beat up a man suspected of being a plainclothes police officer. Several police and protester deaths have been reported across the country. Journalist Ines Abdel-Ala told FSRN the government-controlled media is not helping the situation.
The national media is with the military coup. So how can we come together? There is a very big gap between the two sides of citizens in Egypt.
Government security forces today raided the studios of an Al Jazeera affiliate, according to Reporters Without Borders, and are currently detaining six Al Jazeera employees. Other outlets have also been targeted. The Department of Justice released guidelines yesterday effectively allowing states to regulate marijuana as long as they meet a set of federal priorities. FSRN's Jim Pullen brings us the reaction from Colorado, where recreational use of marijuana is now legal.
Colorado officials say that the state is ready to comply with federal guidelines. U.S. attorneys will now frame marijuana enforcement within the context of eight priorities, including distribution and marketing to minors, cartels and gangs, interstate trafficking, and firearms. State and local jurisdictions will be allowed to regulate marijuana if they implement and enforce rules that effectively address the eight threats. Colorado has moved forward on robust state and local regulations following a November vote that allows adults over 21 to legally grow up to six plants and possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana for recreational use. The new federal guidelines resolve questions about how the government is going to treat large commercial businesses involved in the marijuana industry, says University of Denver Professor Sam Kamen, an expert on marijuana regulation.
And this says, we recognize now that distinction is not a significant one. And in fact says, simply because a business is large and for-profit doesn't mean that's necessarily violating or that we'll prosecute it under the Controlled Substances Act.
A state task force is finalizing rules that must be completed by October 15th. Kamen says that Colorado's robust rulemaking is a model for other states. Jim Pullen, FSRN, Boulder.
And finally, last night in Amsterdam, the Dutch privacy group Bits of Freedom handed out the Big Brother Awards to the two biggest privacy violators of the year. The dubious honors are given out annually in several countries throughout Europe, with recent revelations about widespread U.S. government monitoring of citizen communications. Organizers are seeking to drive home the idea that fighting crime by committing one is not an acceptable tactic. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports from Amsterdam.
The Dutch Minister for Security and Justice, Ivo Opstelten, was the winner of this year's Audience Award. He was given the prize for privacy-violating policies, like one plan to allow police officers to search and even control computers of suspects. Although he was not present at the ceremony in Amsterdam, Opstelten did respond via a video message, in which he jokingly filmed himself with a drone. The US National Security Agency was also nominated. But perhaps the Dutch voters thought it better to stay close to home. American hacker Jacob Applebaum, who gave a keynote speech, noted, in reference to the NSA head, that at least the Dutch minister was generous enough to send a response.
I mean, imagine if we wanted to ask General Alexander for a comment like that. It would never happen.
A jury prize was also given to the Dutch tax office, which accessed information from other governmental agencies that should have been deleted. Peter Teffer, FSRN, Amsterdam.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Western support for a military strike in Syria is narrowing after NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said the alliance had no plans to intervene, and the British House of Commons voted against the action. Prime Minister David Cameron speaking last night after the parliamentary vote.
I strongly believe in the need for a tough response to the use of chemical weapons, but I also believe in respecting the will of this House of Commons. It is very clear tonight that while the House has not passed a motion, it is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly.
Despite the waning support of key allies, the Obama administration says it's still weighing options. Today, officials released a four-page document outlining why the U.S. believes the Syrian government carried out chemical weapon attacks last week. The document states that officials have intelligence that leads them to assess that Syrian government personnel prepared chemical munitions in advance of the attack and were operating in the Damascus suburb of Adra between August 18th and the early morning hours of August 21st when the attacks took place. The document released to the public does not include photos, satellite imagery, audio, or video evidence. Speaking today, Secretary of State John Kerry vowed not to repeat the lead-up to the Iraq War when the U.S. used false information to make the case for the military invasion of Iraq.
Our intelligence community has carefully reviewed and re-reviewed information regarding this attack. And I will tell you, it has done so more than mindful of the Iraq experience. We will not repeat that moment.
The document released by U.S. officials also states that the U.S. intercepted communications involving a senior official intimately familiar with the offensive who confirmed that chemical weapons were used by the regime on August 21st. The document does not identify that Syrian official or include a transcript of the intercepted communications. Kerry acknowledged that the declassified information made public was limited.
In order to protect sources and methods, some of what we know will only be released to members of Congress, the representatives of the American people. That means that some things we do know, we can't talk about publicly.
Kerry called the attacks a crime against humanity and said a preliminary U.S. assessment into deaths found more than 1,400 people killed, including at least 426 children. Anti-war protesters are planning demonstrations in a number of U.S. and global cities Saturday. They also gathered at the White House Thursday, calling for a nonviolent response to the conflict in Syria.
Obama, hands off Syria!
Nora Meir is the anti-drone campaign coordinator at Code Pink. She said a military strike would lead to more civilian deaths.
Even if a chemical weapon was used, and the Assad regime is definitely at fault and is brutal and must be held accountable, this is not the way to do it. If they do end up striking upon Syria, they will be striking on densely populated areas, which is where most of the fighting is taking place. What's going to happen? More and more civilians are going to die.
Human rights groups inside Syria are also calling for more investigations into the attacks on August 21st and non-military options, such as referral of evidence to the International Criminal Court. One of those groups is the Violations Documentation Center. Bassam Al-Ahmed is a spokesperson for the group, also known as VDC, and he joins us now from Istanbul. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you, sir, and welcome to you.
You're in touch with your staff on the ground in multiple cities, also in Damascus, near to the site of the alleged chemical weapons attack. What are you hearing about conditions today?
In Ghouta, there is a lot of brigade and battalion and with the fighting with regime forces. With regard to the bases goods, unfortunately, the area like Ghouta is under siege for more than 1 year. There is a very difficult situation there. The bread, you cannot find any kind of bread because the regime forces didn't allow to enter bread or any kind of gas or anything else.
You talk about the lack of food. What about medical supplies? Residents have raised concern before about a lack of medical supplies, especially after the attack. How is that today?
Yes, also the medical situation, as the doctors and the paramedic in the ground said, the situation is very bad because they are under siege. Doctors and our team in the ground said the situation for everything, it's very bad for foods and also medical issues.
You had a team in Zamalka City on August 25th. That's 4 days after the attacks, but that's also before the UN weapons inspection team was able to reach the site. You spoke to survivors and families of those killed in the attacks. What did they tell you about what happened?
On 21 August, our team in Ghouta, our VDC team in Ghouta, called us, and they said there is a lot of people was killed in attacks by chemical weapons in all of cities in Ghouta. Most of them are children, are women. We was able to document more than 600 of people was killed in this attack.
At the time you reported, many people were missing, families divided. Are people accounted for at this point? Are there people still missing?
Till now, there is hundred of people missing. Nobody know what happened about them. If they are alive or died. Unfortunately, there is no information, no full information about it. But we are trying to collect more information about the real number of victims, the real number of missing people, the real number of wounds.
The U.S., France, and other Western powers are weighing military action in Syria. As an organization that works on the ground in Syria, what would be helpful in your view? What would be productive as a response from the international community at this point?
Actually, as VDC, we are a human rights organization. I think this question, it's more political, but as VDC, as a human rights organization, we want from UN to protect civilians, to protect people in Syria, to transfer the Syrian issue to the ICC. Then they can investigate for crimes in Syria and take action.
So you would support going to the ICC, the International Criminal Court?
Yes, of course. We as VDC want to transfer the Syrian report, the Syrian issue, to the ICC.
If this situation were to go to the ICC, what would you hope the outcome could be?
We hope that there be accountability. And it's very important to us as Syrian people to find accountability for the crimes in Syria.
Bassam al-Ahmad is with the Violations Documentation Center in Syria. The group monitors the conflict and provides weekly and monthly reports on casualties. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your...
This Labor Day, FSRN takes you to the nation's capital for a special documentary.
How about conserving land, water, stopping pollution, and giving food to needy people? You know, this is important.
While elected officials in Congress have long supported big agriculture, a few miles up the road, some D.C. residents are creating an alternative model.
I think until people are able to successfully wrest control over land and over resources away from the profiteering corporations, the sooner we will see something even resembling justice come back into the conversation about how we get our food.
What can decentralized organic urban farming do for local communities? What can it do to address climate change? Find out by listening to FSRN's special documentary, Just Harvest, Urban Farming in a Climate Crisis. That's Labor Day, September 2nd, on Free Speech Radio News. Secret government documents leaked by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden and published by The Washington Post this week have shed light on which agencies get what share of a more than $50 billion annual budget that has so far lacked public oversight. The documents show how much taxpayer money is given to tech companies for handing over private data about their users, and that thousands of government employees work on circumventing encryption. Legal experts and transparency advocates say the government needs to release much more information so the public can have an informed debate on which programs deserve how much taxpayer money. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The U.S. government's intelligence sector has more than 100,000 employees and costs taxpayers more than $50 billion this year alone. The CIA got more than every other spy agency, nearly $15 billion, and more than $2.5 billion of those dollars went to covert action programs, including drone operations in Pakistan and Yemen, payments to local militias in Afghanistan and Africa, and attempts to sabotage Iran's nuclear program. These and other revelations came to light this week in dozens of documents former NSA contractor Edward Snowden passed to The Washington Post. The Post said they're withholding additional documents because U.S. officials they consulted with expressed concerns about the risk to intelligence sources and methods. Scott Amy, the general counsel for the Project on Government Oversight, says there's still a lot the public deserves to know.
Still don't know the amount of money that is spent annually on contractors for the intelligence community. We also don't know how many people are in that workforce and what they're doing. You know, we only have estimates. You know, we think that the contractor workforce now makes up less than 20% of the intelligence community workforce. But for the most part, we don't have a breakdown like we do with other contractors where we really get to see who they're working for, how many people, and what is it costing the federal taxpayer.
The documents leaked by Snowden do detail something called the Corporate Partner Access Project, which compensates telecom corporations who hand over personal user data, either voluntarily or when forced by an order from the FISA court. Those payments were estimated at nearly $280 million for just 2013, but the budget documents do not reveal which individual companies have been paid. The government already has so much of this data that it invested about $50 million this year in researching coping with information overload.
We're moving quickly into a total surveillance state in this country and in others.
That's technology and journalism professor Dan Gilmore at Arizona State University. In the wake of revelations about widespread government tracking of citizens' communications, he has written several essays and columns calling on journalists, activists, and others to start taking steps to protect themselves and their sources. He is one of many experts advocating for wider use of encryption software, open source versions of which are freely available. But the documents published this week show the U.S. government has devoted massive resources to breaking through these privacy protections. A summary of the budget written by Director of National Intelligence James Clapper says, quote, "We are investing in groundbreaking cryptanalytic capabilities to defeat adversarial cryptography and exploit internet traffic." The other documents show that 35,000 employees are assigned to the Consolidated Cryptologic Program, which includes the NSA as well as the surveillance divisions of the Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marines.
I think using encryption is obviously important, but it's not a total solution given the capabilities of criminal hackers as well as security services, which they may not be able to break the encryption directly, but there are other ways to get at information. The thing that journalists have to understand and appreciate is that using electronic communications leaves a trail, and they should act accordingly.
Several government watchdog groups, including the Project on Government Oversight, are calling on the government to release more information about the intelligence budget, especially details on the use of private contractors. They say this would better enable the public to monitor for instances of waste, fraud, and abuse. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Across the country, communities are creating alternatives to the model of industrial agriculture and finding ways to both care for the earth and grow healthy food. One of these solutions is called a food forest, a sustainable method of growing edible plants and trees. One of the nation's largest is Beacon Food Forest in Seattle, Washington, where the urban food movement is transforming parkland 1 acre at a time. FSRN's Martha Baskin has our story.
Standing in Seattle's inner-city neighborhood of Beacon Hill, Jackie Kramer wipes beads of sweat from her brow and looks out at a field of volunteers bringing the food forest to life.
We're standing right now in the Nut and Fruit Guild, and these are nut trees. At the base here is a clover nitrogen fixer. You can use those red blooms for a tea that's high in iron.
A cluster of plum and walnut trees show what's in store for 7 acres of deforested parkland. Trees, ground covers, and fruit-bearing shrubs are planted in proximity so they can work together as families or guilds to create beneficial relationships.
And when we look out at the food forest now, it's a bunch of young saplings. But as it grows, we'll see those trees getting bigger and more shade being cast.
What's being nurtured is a model of permaculture that combines the best of edible landscaping with the natural environment. The goal is to create an ecosystem that can sustain itself and at the same time nourish the bellies and spirits of the local community. After years of meetings between the city of Seattle and those committed to expand the locally grown urban food supply, groundwork is in high gear. At a Saturday work party, 100 volunteers show up, eager to turn Jefferson Park's dry grassland into something it may have never been. A living ecosystem of food and trees. Wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow of wood chips and cardboard are spread over the urban food grower's common enemy, grass. Raised beds are framed meticulously in urbanite, or reused concrete, for both family plots and community plots.
We want to use every bit of space we can for edible or medicinal or herbal or crafting guilds.
Glenn Herlihy is another gardener behind this inner city transformation.
We will have a certain number of 10x10 family plots that are for the family to raise food for their table. But where we're stretching the bounds is we're creating a food forest that's basically a public gleaning area. There's not many of those out there that really advertise that idea.
Fruit and nut trees, blackberries and gumi berries, the medium-sized shrubs from Asia gaining popularity in Western gardeners for their medicinal and sweet taste, will be free to harvest, says Herlihy. People will be trusted to harvest ethically, he explains, and only take what they need.
That's kind of what we're promoting, and that's kind of what we're challenging humanity with.
While he works, a patch of strawberries ripen in the sun, and pumpkins transition from green to mottled orange. On a bed already terraced, lavender and sunflowers beckon pollinators. As more volunteers arrive, the drummers maintain a steady beat. Deputy Mayor Daryl Smith drops by for a tour and chat. If the food forest goes according to plan, he says, it will be a new model, not just for Seattle, but for the country.
Where you can take public property and put it to good use in an area that really needs to have sustainable food.
The Beacon Food Forest is a partnership with the Department of Neighborhood's PPATCH program, who lease the land from Seattle Public Utilities, owners of Jefferson Park's western-facing grassland.
So if this helps us in the South End, more folks to have access to healthy food, and also demonstrates a new way of gardening, that's fantastic.
While the food forest takes root, another urban farmer, Christina Olson, wanted to see more immediate results. With support from the Beacon Garden Club and Rocket Community Arts, she came up with a demonstration garden she calls Beacon, a Hill of Beans, a seasonal project to introduce the wide world of beans to the neighborhood. Cross the other side of the park from the food forest, past the ball fields, and you'll see what looks like an edible apparition. Olson calls it Bean Henge.
It's actually more like a bean teepee, but we like the name Bean Henge better.
Scarlet runner beans, Italian fire tongue, calypso, and other varieties climb trellises attached to a bike spoke balanced horizontally on top of a metal pole. The opening of Bean Henge is aligned to the setting sun. Olson convinced the community center, local teens, merchants along the avenue, and the neighborhood's well-known El Centro de la Raza, or Center for the People, to join the project. For a culturally diverse neighborhood, adds Olson, growing beans in their infinite variety seemed perfect. While food forest gardeners push wheelbarrows of wood chips to cover grass, these gardeners pull buckets of water down Beacon Avenue every day to make sure the beans thrive. Volunteer Betty Jean Williamson checks beans growing on a metal fence at Dragon Auto Repair, Agate Soybeans, and Tiger's Eye.
Now they're just getting tall enough to start reaching the fence to vine up, so we have to try and train them over as they get enough length to get a hold.
As the bean vines continue to spread, the Beacon Food Forest gardeners are preparing for the fall planting, learning how to propagate more plants from existing ones and how to develop their own genetic seed bank. The biggest success story, says Herlihy, who fields calls about the food forest from all over the world, will be to create enough food for everybody.
If we really want to put our action where our words are and say we want to create a local food source that actually can actually supply a large amount of food, this has potential. This has a lot of potential just because the land is ready to grow.
2 acres are under cultivation to date, with 5 more waiting for the community's energy, vision, and spirit. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
FSRN continues our coverage of sustainable farming and alternatives to industrial agriculture on Monday. Be sure to tune in for our special documentary from the nation's capital, Just Harvest, Urban Farming in a Climate Crisis. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sites and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.